Hello and welcome to Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and today I'm joined by Luke Willis to discuss the blockchain and cryptocurrency. Luke is the self-described dApp UX guy. He's a Web3 developer with extensive front-end and UX experience, and he's also the founder of The Coin Press, where he writes a regular newsletter, hosts the Coin Press podcast, and helps others make their dApp ideas a reality. Luke, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me today, Genevieve.
Depending on who you speak to, blockchain and cryptocurrency are either the way of the future or the scam of the century. But few people would be able to tell you what either of them actually is. And that includes data scientists for whom data and technology are a way of life. I personally believe blockchain, along with generative AI, is going to be one of the more important technologies of the next decade. But even I don't fully understand it, which is why I'm doing this episode and why I'm very grateful for you being here, Luke.
Happy to hop on and talk about it. There's a good chance there's some things I don't understand as well. So we'll get through it together.
The thing with blockchain is it's such a cutting edge technology that many of the more traditional educational institutions haven't had time to create courses about it. Which brings me to my first question. Given how cutting edge this technology is, how did you first become involved in blockchain and Web3 development?
Sure. Yeah, good question. I mean, blockchain gets a little bit of a bad rap, as you know, a lot of people say it's still new, still early, but Bitcoin was created in 2009. So we have 14 years behind us. And for many other technologies, that's enough time to reach a certain level of maturity, right? But blockchain has a lot of complexity to it. I have been working in the space for a little over 2 years now. And before that, I had been having various conversations with some roommates and friends who were working in the space. So I had a limited understanding of the inner workings of blockchain, basically conversational knowledge. And then 2 years ago, I threw myself into it to really ramp up my understanding, which is when I started the Coin Press. And that was so that I could talk to people on a podcast and really understand the expert opinion and get my own thoughts about it out and vet that against people who were much smarter than I am. So it's been a very good experience. And in that time, I've been doing the podcast and things, but also built a few dApps as well. So it's been good.
And how did you learn those skills you needed to build those dApps? Because I know there isn't a dApp building 101 university course out there.
Yeah, that's true. I'm a developer by trade. I've been building apps on traditional Web 2, to use the terminology here, infrastructure for a decade or so. And so I'm very familiar with building standard front ends and APIs and database, whatever, right? So what I realized in my research and digging into blockchain is that it's very similar. If you've done web development and you're familiar with creating a front end and talking to an API and a database and all that, crypto and blockchain is really just a different solution to the same problem. And there's a lot more nuance to that, which I'm sure we'll get into. But you can think of it as the data and the data availability layer of your app. And you're pretty close to the truth there. So as far as skills go, if you've done web development, it's not a huge leap to get there.
What programming language do you use to build dApps?
So I use a variety. Lately, I've been doing a lot of React.js on the front end. So JavaScript, TypeScript, depends on the need there. And then for the back end, I've done a little bit of everything. So I've done a lot of C#, a lot of Java, some Node.js, couple other things for one or two projects.
So it's just regular programming languages. There's no special Web3 language.
Well, there is. So when we get to blockchain, it does depend on which blockchain you're building on. If you're building on Ethereum, then the language to use is called Solidity. but it's very similar to JavaScript. There's just, you know, more nuance to learn and different requirements of when to use specific keywords, different ways to optimize it and that sort of thing. But that can all be learned with practice. And there's also great templates out there for building on those chains. For me, I've been building on Coinos, which is a newer blockchain. And so they're a WASM blockchain instead of EVM. For that, I've been using AssemblyScript, which is, again, very similar to TypeScript, JavaScript, kind of that family of languages.
Over the past few minutes, both of us have dropped quite a bit of jargon. So I think it's probably a good idea if we take a step back and just define a few terms before we go too far and lose the entire audience.
Please.
I guess the most obvious question is, what is the blockchain?
So a blockchain is basically a bunch of computers working together on a network, and they're doing a rather specific task, but to create and launch a blockchain, really all it is writing some specific software that knows how to talk to other computers, and then running it on your own computer, getting your friends to run it on their computers, hosting versions of this software in the cloud, wherever it is you want to put it. And then each of those computers that's running the software package, it's now a node on the blockchain. And so in this code that's running the blockchain, it is making peer-to-peer connections with all of the other nodes in the network. And so if one node goes down, it's very fault tolerant in that every node in the network is discovering new nodes and knows about other nodes, and they're all checking each other's work. So if one node says, hey, I'm adding to the blockchain, here's more data, all the other nodes around them receive that in a broadcast, and they start checking that it's correct, and then they repeat it out to the network. And so there's a lot of additional work when you compare that to, you know, a traditional, you know, I'm running one computer, I have one database instance. Now we have who knows how many nodes doing the same work over and over again. So that's where you get, you could say inefficiencies, but it is a trade-off, right? You get a lot of fault tolerance for that inefficiency. So what you have for a blockchain, what a blockchain is it's just a network of nodes that are all agreeing to the same rules of how to add data to a database. And so that database is called a blockchain. And that is because data is structured in blocks that are produced every few seconds, depending on which chain you're on. They might be longer or you know, smaller blocks or bigger blocks or more rapid, or they take a few minutes to produce a block. But every time a node successfully produces a block and broadcasts it, everybody who validates that block and agrees that that's a valid chunk of data, they just chain it. They add it to the database. And then at any point in time, you can look at the state of the database, which has been constructed by this adding of blocks onto the chain. So that's where the name comes from.
As you were describing that, the first thing I thought of before you even said database was, this is just a distributed database.
Except
instead of Google or Amazon or whatever owning all the different databases in right. the network, they're individuals' computers. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. So the only thing that really makes it unique, I mean, there's a lot of unique properties for different blockchains, but the thing that really sets it apart compared to a distributed database owned by Amazon is that it is a permissionless network. So anybody can download the software, run it, and connect and start producing blocks on the blockchain. You don't need permission from Amazon to join the network and become a valid actor. And because of the rules that have been baked into the code, even if you join this network with your own client that you create and you try to do things that are malicious to break the blockchain, because of that fault tolerance and that decentralization of control, you can't do it, right? If you say, no, I'm going to add this fake data into the blockchain, I'm going to cheat everybody out of money and that kind of thing, all of the other nodes on the blockchain will see that you're lying and they won't allow your data and they'll punish you and do all kinds of things to prevent you from doing bad things to the data.
What happens if I own over 50% of the nodes in the blockchain?
So that depends on the blockchain. Each one has kind of different things that can happen in that situation. And it also depends on kind of the economics of the chain. So certain blockchains use what's called proof of work, which is basically however much computer power you're contributing to the network means that you control that percentage of the network. So if you have a really beefy machine or you've written really clever code so that you can do things more efficiently compared with other people, then you may be producing more computer power, or we say hash rate. And so you would make up a larger percentage of the network on a proof of work network. Others use proof of stake, proof of burn. There's a bunch of other more nuanced ones where your percentage of the network is based on your ownership of the token. And so without going too far down that rabbit hole just yet, the token is just cryptocurrency. It's the money that you own as a percentage of the network. And so one of the things that's on the database, the blockchain, is who owns what money, basically. And so if I send money to you and you send money to me and, you know, whatever, that's all great, but that makes up your stake or your percentage of the total amount of money in the system. And so for those blockchains, just adding more computer power, you won't be able to do anything to take control of 51% of the network and change the outcome. You would need to actually acquire 51% of the tokens in order to do something malicious. But yeah, regardless of, and that's called the consensus algorithm, regardless of what consensus algorithm the network is using, if you control 51% or more of the, whatever the limiting factor is, you can cheat. You can say, I'm going to add additional data, or I'm going to double spend these tokens, or there's a lot of different things that you can do and get away with. So that's why when we talk about 51% attack, it's something to be avoided for sure.
I would say it would presumably be impossible with the older, more established blockchains. But mm-hmm. if someone like me were to invent a new blockchain with right. limited take-up, I could quite easily control 51% of it.
Certainly, yeah. And if you're so yeah, for existing networks, if we're talking about Bitcoin, which is, you know, the first network and has a proof of work consensus algorithm, it costs millions of dollars per hour to attack the network. And so it's not economically viable given what you could pull off. It's not worth the trade-offs, right? Additionally, if you did that, you'd be devaluing the currency. And so you'd lose a lot of money in the process as a result. A lot of the concerns here of, well, what if that happens, basically come down to, is it worth it? From a business perspective, am I just going to lose money by doing this? And for a lot of things, the answer is yes. And so getting back to your question, which was, remind me.
Controlling 51% of the network. And if it's a small enough network, you should be able to do it.
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you. Yeah. If you're creating a new blockchain, then yeah, you have the power to distribute that token initially, however you see fit. And so if you just gave yourself 51% of the tokens and sold the other 49%, then yeah, immediately you have full control of the network. And that's not a good place to be. Most blockchains that get launched these days come up with some mechanism of distributing the tokens. They'll usually allocate a percentage to the team, And then sometimes they'll lock up tokens for a period of time, and then they'll sell the other ones. And so there's lots of things that they do to prevent that from happening. But usually the thing to look for is what percentage is being allocated versus what percentage is being sold or mined or however it's being distributed.
Yeah, because if one person holds 51%, it would scream out scam to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you've mentioned tokens while you're discussing the blockchain. I assume by tokens, that's effectively cryptocurrency.
Correct, yeah.
So how does that work?
Yeah, so going back to the database concept, right? It is just a database. And when we look at traditional finance databases, it's just money. It's all just numbers in a database. Your account number holds this value, and we can add numbers and subtract numbers and all that. And so with a traditional database, theoretically, somebody at the bank, let's say, could go in and change a number in a database and, you know, give themselves an extra $10 or something like that. There's a lot of security controls and audit systems and things that are supporting to prevent that from happening, but it is still all controlled within the bank, right? If somebody made the software wrong, or if somebody had the right password, you know, theoretically that sort of thing could happen. On a blockchain, you still have this account holds this value, but nobody has the keys to change that. So there's only specific things that can be done, because anything else you tried to do would get broadcast in the network and everyone say, that's not a valid thing you can do. So it would never be accepted as an actual change to the database by the network. You can do it on your own machine all you want, but nobody's going to recognize that you own that money. So yeah, so basically, if you are, if we're talking about tokens and cryptocurrency, what that is it's just numbers in the database. And we use the term tokens because we think of it as like a transferable money that you actually pass around. So the physical concept of a token is a better representation than just saying numbers in a database, because you can't just mess with it like you can with numbers in a database. You actually have to destroy it, or maybe it's created, or it is transferred from one account to another. So there's specific things that can happen.
It seems more like stocks in a company. You know, you buy 100 units of stocks in Apple or whatever.
Yeah, that's a pretty good representation. But I mean, again, when we talk about getting into the nitty gritty of that, a stock market is just another database, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, but yeah, it's a representation of a share in a company, where if you hold Bitcoin or ETH or whatever, you have a share of the network. So the difference is that a stock is actually a representation of an entity that is creating value in the world, hopefully, and you're betting on the value of what they're creating and what they're producing, or how they're serving the world and the economic side of that. For crypto, there's no company behind the scenes, right? You're just owning a percentage of this network. So from that perspective, it's more like currency, where if you own a dollar, that's not like there's no company behind that. It's just the United States and their creation of this dollar bill. And you believe in the promises of the Federal Reserve, and it's useful to you because all of your stores around your house accept it. And so you use it. Crypto is more like that, where, you know, it's a dollar. It's not, there's nothing behind it. It's just the promises of the network and the rules around it, similarly to how the government has rules of how dollars are used and created.
So basically, I mean, with a dollar, the government has convinced the population that this piece of paper is worth $1. And Correct. That's how the whole economy works. So with cryptocurrency, the cryptocurrency creator has convinced the world that one Bitcoin is worth whatever. And as long as people are willing to pay that for it, it is worth whatever.
Right. Well, and that comes down to supply and demand, really. Like it's traditional economics where it's not really up to the government to say, this is worth this much. You know, they could influence supply and demand by saying, you can always come to the government store and exchange $1 for a dozen eggs. You know, now they've kind of created a floor price of, you know, this dollar is always worth this much. Or, but if they're printing too many dollars, they don't have enough eggs. You know, so there's kind of a shell game of how much can we print and how much will people spend and all those things, where on a blockchain, there's no central entity behind the scenes. It's just all the different people participating in the network. And if more people want the token, then the price goes up naturally because of supply and demand. And if more people want to sell the token, then it goes down.
So all cryptocurrency lives on the blockchain, but I'm assuming that cryptocurrency is not the only use for the blockchain. What else can you do with the blockchain?
So the sky's the limit. I mean, think about servers and databases, and it's kind of like asking, what can you do with a server and a database? The answer is really whatever you want. It's just a matter of what you code it to do. And so for blockchains, the initial blockchain, Bitcoin, really only did money. And so they've kept to that vision, but they have additional things that you can do off of the network that then kind of cheat to get additional data in by transferring very small amounts of money around and kind of making the data say things that aren't money. And so they've basically taken a square peg, which is to build an app that does whatever, and force it into the circle hole of a money application, where other blockchains like Ethereum, Coinos, the one that I've built on, they're what's called a general purpose blockchain. So it's more of a server that anybody can code on. So when you're building a dApp or decentralized application, you're actually coding let's say an API with control over a certain portion of the database, and you're deploying it onto the network. And so you can write the code in a Turing complete language, and anybody can then use your code who can access the network. So you can build a front end that talks to the blockchain and uses the smart contract, is what we call it, that you built, or somebody else can build a different front end that talks to yours, or they can just build a statistics dashboard that goes and analyzes all the data that is in your portion of the database for your dApp and do all kinds of analysis on the data that people using your dApp are creating.
So, as a data scientist, if I had created a dApp, I could extract the data relate from the database relating to my dApp and then do everything I could normally do with normal data. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, when it comes down to that data science piece, the benefit is that because blockchain is permissionless, anybody can use it, anybody can see all the data because it's all public. As a data scientist, there's a treasure trove of information out there for specific dApps, but also for accounts. So you can actually draw, you know, you can dig deep onto, let's say, Uniswap, right? And see all the trading activity going on for different tokens on the blockchain. Or you could take kind of a horizontal approach and say, I see that these three accounts traded this token and then went and used this other dApp that does something completely different and then did this. So, because all of the data is public across all the dApps and all the accounts, you can do very interesting things depending on how you slice the data.
Oh, so this is interesting. So, if there was a distributed database on AWS, unless it was my database, I wouldn't be able to get at it. But what you're saying is that I could theoretically get all the data for all the dApps and analyze to my heart's content.
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah. Is it tabular data or some sort of JSON type blob?
Yeah, so it depends on which blockchain you're using. The data that I'm using on Poynos, it's basically JSON by the time you get it out. And so I believe most blockchains do something similar using RPC is a standard format for like talking to the blockchain. But yeah, it's basically just JSON data. It's structured as blocks, which contain transactions, which have operations, which are records of this account talked to this application and did this thing. And this was the result.
Wow. This is really cool. Okay. As soon as this episode's over, I want to start trying to get at some of this data. Okay. You've mentioned multiple blockchains and you know, everyone knows about Bitcoin and Ethereum, but you're an obvious supporter of Coinos. Why is Coinos your weapon of choice?
Yeah. So like I said, I got into this 2 years ago and the roommate that was deep into this field, he is one of the co-founders of the group that created the Coinos blockchain. So when they were working on it and I was learning from the background, I wanted to get deeper into it. So that's why I started there. Now I've stayed because of the design decisions that they've made and what they've built. I think it's a really high quality piece of software and does something unique compared to all the other blockchains that are out there today. So to explain what that is, I have to go back a little bit and say, let's look at Ethereum. Ethereum was the first general purpose blockchain, which just means that anybody can code an application that runs on the chain. And they were able to do that because of the there's a lot of innovation that went into it. But one of the things that was a core concept is gas fees. So if you start using these blockchains, that's something that's going to come up rather quickly. So anytime that you submit a transaction to be included in a block, you have to pay to use the resources of the blockchain. And so on Ethereum, this was called gas. And so you can actually bid more gas to get your transaction prioritized and, you know, have it resolve much faster. But the system is just, it's called gas fees, and it's just a fee to pay for your transaction. And this has been a source of frustration for people ever since Ethereum launched. And every other chain that's followed has basically replicated this design. There have been attempts to, you know, change it or hide it and various things on Ethereum and on other blockchains. But Coinos has taken a different approach where instead of having fees, where you're paying with money, with cryptocurrency, you're actually paying with time. So what you have is an opportunity cost instead of a monetary cost. And the structure of it is it's called a mana fee or mana cost instead of a gas fee. And so mana is the resource that is basically a measurement of time. So instead of saying, I will pay one coin to submit this transaction, what you say is, I will lock up this coin for 5 days to do this transaction. And so now you've basically committed to not being able to spend, transfer, or use that token for additional transactions for a period of time. And so there's still like a real economic hit by doing that, but it allows you to hide a lot of the pain that comes from gas fees. And the reason that this whole discussion is necessary, and talking about gas fees or mana cost, is because you don't want people to just be able to come in and spam the network with whatever data they want. Resources are expensive, and the more data gets put on the chain, the more costly it is to keep the network alive and have things continue to operate smoothly. So Ethereum, because it is so well used and everybody is, you know, so excited about Ethereum and using the network, and there's so many tokens and dApps on there, gas can get very expensive. It can be hundreds of dollars to submit a simple transaction for something that a normal user who hasn't been in that ecosystem for, you know, for since the beginning, they just can't afford it. So normal people are priced out of the discussion. But the whole idea of gas fees is still necessary. So when we talk about mana cost, it's a totally flipped perspective, because instead of having to think about, you know, oh, can I afford the $200 now, or should I wait for when fewer people are using the network so it's only $20, now it's just free. You don't have to think about the cost because it's all time. And you can hit a point where, you know, you've used up all your mana and now you're stuck. You can't use the network anymore until you get more, and it'll regenerate over time. But it's not something that you have to feel in your pocketbook. It's just a time constraint. And this is a design that we see in, you know, mobile games, where money's not even a concern. Instead of it being, you know, are you going to pay 10 gold to open this chest or whatever? It's, are you going to wait 4 hours to open this chest, right? And then you click on it, you have to wait for it. Maybe you can spend some gems to speed it up or something, you know, however that's designed in the game. But that's really where this concept comes from. It's a real, mana is a concept in video games and Dungeons and Dragons and going back. And it's a renewable resource that powers your ability to use magic. So yeah, from that perspective, I'm able to use Koinos for my dApps, for other people's dApps, without having to think about the money side of it. And so whatever money I put in, I know it's still there after I'm done using the chain.
Yeah, and for smaller people who mm-hmm. aren't backed by some big corporation, this is going to be something that's a very real consideration.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's where it gets really interesting to me, because while it's a much nicer experience for me as somebody who holds coins, most people who are coming into the blockchain world don't have tokens. And so they don't care about going and buying tokens to be able to use some application on the internet. That's an unnecessary step that prevents people from using apps built on Ethereum and other blockchains, because you have to have the tokens to pay for the gas before you can use the app. And so you're excluding all kinds of people there. And so Koinos, I can actually, if I'm a developer and I own coin, then I can use my mana to pay for other people's usage of my application. So now I can still just hold all my coin and pay for the mana for any number of people off the street to come in and use my app and actually interact with the blockchain and submit transactions. And it doesn't cost me anything. It's still just my time. Now, there's a limit to how much usage I can support with how much coin I have, but it's very powerful to be able to say, I can support people and they can use my app. And I don't have to run any infrastructure because it's all just the blockchain. I don't need to host a server. I don't need to host a database. All I need to do is just hold on to these tokens and everything just operates smoothly.
What I think's interesting is when the blockchain first started to become a thing, one of the things that I remember reading was that the benefit of blockchain is that it's decentralized. So it makes all of these benefits available to the people. But it sounds like with things like Ethereum, where you've got those high gas fees, mm-hmm. that the costs of paying for those gas fees potentially are prohibitive to ordinary people who can't afford them. But something like Koinos, by having that mana concept, is bringing it back to the what was originally said about the blockchain, that it makes it available to ordinary everyday people.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment, because Ethereum, yeah, it's not accessible to normal people. There have been other blockchains created that still use this gas concept, but it's, you know, it's a lot cheaper. It's pennies or less than a penny to submit a transaction. And that's better. But the problem is that you still have to get tokens before you can use the blockchain. And so changing that so you don't even have to have tokens, that's a much better design. And other blockchains are waking up to this. I think that there's going to be a lot more usage of this kind of system where people don't need to have their own gas tokens because apps are paying for the usage. So it's really a question of which economic model will be more successful, which chain's going to capture the most users and that sort of thing. So I don't know. This isn't financial advice. I'm not suggesting anybody go and buy coin or anything. But for me, I like the design and it's fun to build on it and fun to use.
With the gas costs, if I was to extract data from the Ethereum blockchain, would I have to pay gas fees?
Good question. No. So if you're reading data from the blockchain and you're not, you know, deploying an app or writing data to the blockchain, then that's all free. You do need to have access to the blockchain. So you could run your own node and, you know, read all the data from the blockchain and then interact with your own node. But that takes time. It takes a while to sync up and download the database from all the other participants. So for most people, you find, you know, a company that is already running a node that you can talk to. And for simple things, especially like talking through an app, you don't need to pay that company to access their nodes. But if you were building an app or a data dashboard or something, they may have some costs to integrate with their data endpoint, basically.
And I'm sure there are services on the internet where you can pay some monthly fee and you can download away.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all, at that point, it's going to be usage based. So if you're talking to one of the big one for Ethereum is called Infura. And so if you were using Infura and you needed to download a couple gigabytes or, you know, the whole, you know, terabytes of data or whatever, there would be a cost based on how much you were using.
But it's easier than setting up your own node.
Yes. Well, yeah. Maybe easier.
Easier for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned dApps and how you've built dApps. So a dApp is a application on the blockchain, I take it.
Yeah.
Can you give us some examples of some of the dApps you've built?
Yeah, good question. So the first dApp that I built was basically an NFT, which is a non-fungible token. So we've already talked about cryptocurrency, and that's what's called a fungible token. So just to explain that briefly, a dollar is fungible. My $1, despite the fact that it's crumpled up and ripped a little bit, is still worth $1. It's the same as somebody else's crisp new $1 bill. Compare that to non-fungible tokens. You can think of that as pieces of art or phones would be non-fungible, right? Just because, you know, this one's mine. It has my information in it and it's a year old and it has a scratch right here and it's different from somebody else's, even though it's the same model. So that's what, you know, the fungible, non-fungible side of it. And so NFTs get a bad rap as being just, you know, monkey pictures on the blockchain.
Yeah.
but the concept is really just a non-fungible piece of data that is transferable, can be created, can be destroyed, but it can represent anything. So if you're building a game and you want to have your players trading cards or something like that be represented on the blockchain, those would be NFTs. And they would be something that players could trade back and forth, either for money or for other cards. And that would all just be baked into the system of the blockchain because accounts and trading and transfers and all these things are already well defined by the ecosystem. So it's not something that you have to build. You just say, here's a new NFT and it represents this. And then by default, you get all of the other ecosystem things for free because it's all plug and play with all of the other applications that are on the blockchain. So that was my first app. We can come back to NFTs. But yeah, I built an NFT and a website that let you mint or create the NFTs and own them and all that stuff. The second one I built was an app called Burncoin, which is basically a staking pool where if you want to earn some profit on your tokens, you could run your own node on your local computer or something in the cloud and, you know, earn profit for contributing to the network. but the pool allows you to just deposit your tokens and then share in the profits generated by the node that I'm running. So,
okay. I guess, I mean, it's just how regular finance works. I buy shares in a company and then they use my money to do useful stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a really good representation of it, because if you are, you know, if you have money, you could go and actually hand it to your brother-in-law who's starting a company and he's going to earn you some return on your money. But then, you know, maybe it's locked up for so many years and you may never see it come back and all that. Or you could deposit it in an account that is diversified and pools everybody's resources together to earn a profit through real estate and investing in companies and, you know, doing whatever. And so a pool is really that. It's a place for multiple people to deposit and benefit from the work of one node or one, you know, venture behind the scenes, which will just share the profits across all the depositors.
Did you have to have a financial services license to build that?
I didn't, because I'm not actually providing a financial service. I built the code that lets you deposit and withdraw, and I'm running the node that is interacting with the blockchain, but I'm not actually doing anything with your money. The blockchain is doing its normal business, and that's it. So I'm not going and taking your money out. I'm not actually taking control of your money. I can't pull your money out even if I wanted to. All I'm doing is running a computer. And then the last one that I built is a name service. So this is another NFT where if you wanted to get your name as like a usable token that represents who you are, you could get Genevieve.coin or any number of other names that you wanted. And it's basically just a username on the blockchain, but it's something that's transferable and it's something that maybe holds value for other people. So if you got a specific name that was particularly rare or a, you know, particularly short name or something, other people might want that. And so the tradability of that is not something that I'm, you know, specifically playing on. I'm not suggesting that the value of these names is going to go up over time or something like that. But if you want to buy and sell them specific names, you can, where if you're on Twitter and you get your name or somebody else already has your name, you have no way of getting it, right? There's no marketplace where you could go get the name you want. So it's more like a domain name from that perspective, because you can get your favorite.com and sell it, buy it, whatever you want. So it's an open marketplace for names.
So it's a marketplace rather than the equivalent of a domain name server. Is that right? Or does it have the DNS built into it as well?
The dApp that I built was the name service, but because it's on blockchain, you benefit from the marketplace side of it as well.
Okay. That's pretty cool. So after listening to this episode, I know I want to go out and start playing with some of this blockchain data. And I suspect some of our listeners may be inspired to give blockchain a go as well. For people wanting to get started with either playing around with the blockchain data or with dApp development, where would be the best place to begin?
So if you're interested in looking at Coinos, there's two websites that I would start with. One is coinosblocks.com. The other is coiner.app. Those are both block explorers, which is just a website that lets you go click around and look at blocks, transactions, accounts, and all the activity that's happening on the blockchain right now. If you want to go with some more established chains that have more data and more, probably more interesting things to look at for now, Bitcoin, there's a number of block explorers there. You can just look up Bitcoin block explorer and any number of those would be fine. Ethereum, the big ones, Etherscan. But yeah, again, if you just want to type in the name of the blockchain and block explorer, then you can go look at all of the data there, and that'll be free. You don't need to go pay for a server connection or anything like that to do that, because it's already paid for by that app that's set up. So the benefit there is you get to go play around, right? You get to go see some data and start to understand what you're looking at and see blocks being created, transactions being included. And initially, these things are very overwhelming. There's a lot of data and a lot of crypto hashes and things going on that are above the standard expectation of looking at data, right? So start there, click around, ask questions. If anybody listening to this wants to go click around and see something that doesn't make sense, you can certainly email me or DM me on Twitter. I'm always happy to help with explanations and write about it on my own newsletter and that kind of thing. But yeah, that's a great way to get introduced to it. And then as you build up your understanding of the specific concepts and how blocks are structured and transaction data and that sort of thing, then you can go look at creating dashboards and your own custom dApps and that sort of thing.
So I'm guessing that a lot of this data is going to look a lot like financial data. So the sort of like the data you'd get if you downloaded stock exchange data.
Probably quite a bit of it. It does depend on which blockchain you're on. Where Bitcoin, a lot of it is just, you know, token transfers. That's really the majority of transactions that happen on Bitcoin. But there's a lot of other things that are in that data that you wouldn't notice if you were downloading, you know, a spreadsheet of financial data. Things like block IDs and hashes for the proof of work, you know. So there's a lot of things that are happening with every block or for every transaction that you can think of as just really metadata that you could probably just ignore when you're trying to get at the meat of what's this person actually doing. But it's still something that you have to learn to weed through and recognize.
What final advice would you give to data scientists who are looking to create business value from data or from the blockchain?
Yeah, well, I think that the thing to take away from blockchain, even if you don't use it specifically, is just the model of decentralization, where when you're looking at data traditionally, it's owned by somebody, right? And it's private and there's different authorizations and rules and that sort of thing. And whether or not it's encrypted or hashed is not really a thing you care about, right? It's more just, what can I see? What can other people see? Who's authorized to access this and that kind of thing. So from a traditional data science perspective, you don't think about, you know, should I encrypt this or should this be hashed or and that sort of thing. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but from a blockchain perspective, everything's out in the open. All the data can be seen by anyone at any time. So when you're analyzing data and what's actually happening on chain, there's a lot of things that actually get obfuscated and hidden by hashing it or by encrypting it. And so what you get is you have to pay more attention to, what does this actually represent? Is this token, you know, can I actually see what the data is, or is it going to be revealed at a future date by somebody off chain? Because if I'm submitting a hash onto the blockchain, no one actually knows what the data is, but I can cryptographically prove that I have the data by, you know, some future date when I produce the data, I submit the data and the hash of the data, and people can verify that it actually represents the thing that's been on chain for years. So there's interesting use cases when it comes to blockchain and how data is hidden, how it's shared, how it's public and encrypted and all these things that kind of stretch your imagination in ways that you don't get with traditional private networks with authorization models.
So you could theoretically have people's banking passwords on the blockchain as long as they were encrypted. I mean, I wouldn't encourage it, but no, you could have it.
you certainly could. Generally, I try to be careful about putting just encrypted data, because if and when quantum algorithms crack a lot of our encryption stuff, that data is still out there. And so, yeah, generally speaking, it's okay to do like a one-way hash of data to stick it on, because no one will be able to reverse that. But encrypting with like a two-way algorithm, that you can get yourself into future problems if you don't plan ahead.
I'm interested to see what happens with all the encryption once quantum becomes a big thing.
Yeah. It's going to be a very interesting dilemma for a lot of blockchains and a lot of other applications as well.
Yeah, the one I'm interested in seeing what happens with is things like self-driving cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you could have all sorts of really bad things happening there.
Absolutely. Well, fortunately, we already have some quantum resistant things going on in the blockchain space and off. So researchers are coming up with good solutions for these things. It's a question of when they should be adopted and in what ways.
For listeners who want to learn more about you or get in contact, what can they do?
Yeah, so if anybody listening to this found it interesting and wants to know more about my work, the easiest way to find me is to go to lukewillis.com, and I have links to all the different dApps I've built there, my newsletter, my podcast, and yeah, basically everything I'm doing, social networks and all that stuff.
And I do encourage listeners to sign up to the newsletter and listen to the podcast, because that was how I first started to learn about CoinOS and the blockchain. And that was what gave rise to this episode.
Appreciate it. Yeah, you've sent some very interesting questions back to some of my emails that have prompted further writing. So if anybody has questions, you can always send them my way. I enjoy writing about and thinking about the different things that you're thinking about.
Okay, well, thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. This has been fun.
And for those in the audience, thank you for listening. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and this has been Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting.